You're listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast.
So we decided to do this show because there's this great article that my mom sent me.
Did she really? Your mom sent this?
She's finally figuring out what I do for a living. titled A Different Path to Fighting Addiction, written by Gabrielle Glazer. And it was, I just was so impressed that my mom, she thought I might be interested in it. And it was. So we decided to go with
Seeing as you're in the field of addiction treatment.
So we also have, so tonight we're going to be talking about the different paths to addiction treatment, the different kinds of addiction treatment out there, what is out there, what should be out there, and how a family can kind of navigate this insane maze.
It is insane. We talk about it all the time.
I mean, you wouldn't say, hi, I have cancer. I think I'll Google, see who the best, what the best treatment is for it.
And whoever spends the most money on Google results wins.
That's right. So tonight we have two guests joining us.
We have, on the phone, we're going to have Gabrielle Glazer, who Abby mentioned. She's an award-winning journalist and author, most recently of the New York Times bestseller, Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control, which comes out on paperback on Tuesday, July 15th. Gabrielle has examined over the past two decades social, cultural, and national health trends for the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, the Oregonian in Portland, where she was a staff writer. Her work has also appeared in The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, LA Times, Glamour, Mademoiselle, Scientific American, and on and on. She's author of a couple other books as well. And we have a pre-recorded interview I did with David Sheff, who's been on the show before. David Sheff is another New York Times journalist and best-selling author of the books Beautiful Boy and Clean. And we use Clean.
It's on my list of books I recommend for every parent to read if they have a kid in treatment.
We give it out to everybody saying, please read this. And it contextualizes addiction treatment, substance abuse treatment in the United States, what to look for in treatment. So we talked to David after he spoke at an addiction treatment conference in California about his views of treatment. So I'd like to welcome Gabrielle Glazer to Right Turn Radio. Welcome, Gabrielle.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Hi, so thank you for writing the article. And I wanted you to know that my mother finally has figured out what I do because of the article. So
I'm glad to have helped that process along. That's great.
So John and I are, I'm a social worker, licensed social worker, and John is a
Addictions counselor, certified and licensed addictions counselor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and we do this radio show to try to get the word out to the rest of the world about what to look for and what to do.
Oh, that's so great.
So we're going to listen a little bit to my interview with David Sheff, and we hope that, Gabrielle, you and Abby and I can kind of contextualize some of this stuff and talk about what you've learned about treatment options in the United States. This really interesting craft program that you speak about in the article. So let's go to that first segment from the David Sheff interview. Your talk at a recent addiction conference was called Beyond Clean, Where the Treatment Industry Still Needs to Go. Why is this subject important to you?
Well, it's important to me because I found out the hard way that the treatment system, you know, what happens when we ourselves or someone we love needs treatment for drug addiction is the treatment system is just a mess. I mean, it's really a disaster. If we had any other problem, any other health problem, you know, it's pretty straightforward. We go to a doctor and they give us a checkup and they figure out what we need and send us to referrals, whatever. But with this system, we end up in the hands of people who just in many cases don't know what we're what they're doing, and we get, you know, spend a fortune on bad treatment. And so I because of the experience with my son, I, you know, went through this whole thing trying to figure out what works actually, and he's doing better. I mean, he's been in recovery, but I meet many, many people who just have had the, you know, disasters, tragedies, including the death of someone they loved. And so I've really devoted myself to try to figure out, you know, not just what's wrong with this treatment system, but, you know, what should be out there.
So let's go through this step by step. What is wrong? What, you know, what are you seeing that is wrong in the whole system? Is there any problems that are endemic to the whole treatment system, or is it specific types of treatment that need help?
I think it's endemic to the system at this point, and the reason is because, you know, we're coming out of a time when we didn't understand the science behind drug addiction. You know, now we know that this is a brain disease, it's a mental illness, and we know how to treat, you know, diseases. We have the medical model, but this disease has always been treated as if it was not a an illness, but in fact is instead, you know, a choice, a bad choice, you know, sort of a bad choice of people who were, you know, derelict and selfish and immoral. And so we didn't treat them with any sort of compassion. We didn't treat them with any of the sort of the you know, sort of the research, the evidence, the kinds of ways that we know. You know, we figured out, we still don't treat all cancers, of course, but we have gotten so much better because we figured out what cancer is, and we're working to figure it out, tackle it one by one. But in the in this industry, you know, if you go into a rehab program, you go into places where there's not one person that has any credentials. Kids are yelled at as they're because they're not following the rules, and you're talking about, you know, 17-year-old kids who aren't going to follow the rules anyway, and then you've got one who's on methamphetamine, which is what was the case in my son's story. And so this system is based on this archaic idea that people need to, that in a sense, addicts are bad people, they're sinners, whatever. And so what happens when you've got someone who's a bad person, you know, it all depends, the whole system involves contrition, it involves prayer, it involves asking for forgiveness. But that's not what works. I shouldn't say that. It works for some people, but it doesn't work for most people. Most people need to be seen by someone who actually is trained in addiction medication, I'm sorry, in addiction medicine, and can offer a whole range of proven treatments that includes different kinds of therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, medications in some cases, 12 steps in some cases. And the treatment system is evolving, so that's where we're going, but we have such a long way to go.
So in that, I mean, I think the most important thing about what he was saying is the premise of treatment used to be that the people who addicts were bad, and now it's turning out that there's something wrong with them. And that's something, Gabrielle, that's something you talked about in your article a lot too. Why did you write the article? What was inspiring you to get the word out?
Well, I've written, I wrote this book on women and alcohol, and I, in part of the book, I examined what works, what treatments work, what treatments don't work, and I don't, you know, I don't intend to echo David, but I can certainly speak a little bit more to that, and where we're going in terms of research, in terms of the neuroscience, in terms of shifting public opinion toward what will really help the millions of people who are out there who need help and who aren't getting the right kind of help. So what propelled me to write the piece was I am interested in binge drinking and especially how parents and kids kind of handle that situation. And when kids get out of control with their drinking, how best do you tackle that problem? And because I live in New Jersey, I'm just outside of Manhattan, I turned to this group in New York called the Center for Motivation and Change, and they use an array of tools, just as David was speaking about. They use motivational interviewing, which helps clients work on their ambivalence about mm-hmm. why they are using drugs or drinking too much. They use cognitive behavioral therapy. They use harm reduction methods, which are intended to kind of reduce the negative consequences from using behaviors and or other unhealthy behaviors, and they really try to look at the individual instead of the problem itself as one that can be answered with a single, you know, one-size-fits-all program.
So it sounds to me like you're saying that there's a compassionate, a kind of a newer treatment modality based on science, based on motivational interviewing, based on empathic discourse, and not such a kind of a strict black and white view of abstinence and substance use.
Absolutely. And one specifically, one that really interestingly to my ears anyway, we have this history of using a word to shorthand to describe, oh, well, he's just an alcoholic, or oh, she's just an addict. Oh, well, that's my addict brain. You know, sometimes you hear people describe themselves that way, and once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. But this isn't, there's a new group of folks out there of researchers and clinicians and therapists who work from the research standpoint that has found that's not necessarily true. And it may be true for a small percentage of people, but the number of people who use alcohol riskily or who use drugs riskily, who use substances in a risky fashion, are not necessarily all addicts. And in fact, that's a word that they don't even like to use.
That's we're trying to change some of the words that we use, because if you call yourself something, you eventually become that, or that informs the way you look at yourself. So we're talking to Gabrielle Glaser, New York Times author of a recent article about treatment in the United States, and we're also listening to our interview with author David Sheff and about treatment in the United States. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We'll be right back after a break.
Gabrielle, you were talking right before we had to break about there are different modalities. There are different kinds of treatment you can look for. In the article, you talk about it. Can you kind of explain to us and people what's out there and what has been out there and what you see?
Yes. One of I refer to this a lot in my reporting because it is by far the best study, and it was a study conducted in the early 2000s. It was published in 2002. And I know that sounds like a really long time ago, but the research hasn't changed that much. And I think you probably know that I'm referring to there was a meta-analysis of more than 50 different approaches. And the researchers there were at the University of New Mexico really analyzed all of these. And by far, the best was a brief intervention by a medical professional, someone saying, sitting you down and saying, you know what, here are you, you've got, you're going to have consequences from this, and we need to get you some sort of help. And cognitive behavioral therapy is also an incredibly important and effective thing to do for addictions. And cognitive behavioral therapy helps people determine their negative thought processes and turn them around, their beliefs about themselves, beliefs they might have about a substance, about an event in their lives. And it's been shown to be very, very effective in helping people who use substances recover. Motivational interviewing, which I talked about before, really examines the ambivalence that someone who drinks too much or someone who uses substances in a very risky way has about that substance and about giving it up as opposed to or changing it in any way, changing their relationship to that substance.
Change talk. Yes.
Change talk, exactly. So instead of someone ordering, let's say a 40-year-old woman is drinking two bottles of wine a night, instead of someone ordering this woman into never drinking again for the rest of her life and telling her that she has a disease that can only be cured by 12-step meetings, which may not be appropriate for her. Maybe she was sexually abused. Maybe she is medicating depression or anxiety, which is very common among women. Instead of saying, you have to do it and you have to do this way, with a program that worked for us and worked for people and has worked for people since 1935, when knowledge of neurology was in its infancy, it basically says, okay, let's talk about your drinking. It's time for us to talk about your drinking. What does drinking do for you? What does it not do for you? It encourages people, motivational interviewing encourages people to use, and so does cognitive behavioral therapy, encourages people to use cost-benefit analyses. Okay, what's good about your drinking? What's bad about your drinking? And sometimes when people see the value of their when they see the discrepancy in their own value system, it's really impetus for them to change their behaviors, not necessarily stop, but to change their behaviors. You know, we have this idea that the only way a person who has a problem can get better is if they stop and stop completely and stop for the rest of their lives. And science doesn't back that up. Not for everybody. Maybe for some people, for a minority of people who really get into trouble with substances, but not for everybody.
Well, it's interesting because we see a population in our clinic that is that smaller minority often, although we see the, you know, the ones that are, you know, some of the ones you're describing, but we do see the, you know, the people who have, you know, many treatment episodes, a lot of opiate addicts, you know, that have had a lot of things like that, but the same things still work. We still employ the same things: motivational interviewing, CBT, DBT, harm reduction, meeting them where they're at, it sounds like what you're talking about, instead of creating this wall of resistance by saying, you have to do this or you're a bad person. That doesn't engage the person. That doesn't make them interested in change.
On the contrary, you know, exactly. And on the contrary, it just makes them feel worse about themselves and more likely to go underground with their behavior and their with their risky behavior. It really doesn't, you know, if you think about parenting, you know, when you tell your kid, you ought to be ashamed of yourself, you're such a bad girl, you did this, I can't believe this, go to your room until you can be a good girl, that doesn't necessarily inspire confidence in a person or the feeling of empowerment. If you say, you know, I'm really unhappy that you did this, this is wrong, and I'm going to tell you why, and we need to look at this behavior, and I'd like you to go think about it, and come back to me when you've got some answers about how we might avoid this in the future, you're probably going to have a better outcome with the second tactic than you are with the first. And I don't mean to be comparing people to, you know, children, people who are using substances riskily to children, but it's really, you know, human nature, frankly. And we have evolved a very long way as a society, as scientists, as researchers, as clinicians since 1935. And, you know, certainly if 12-step programs work for people, that's great, that's fantastic, and that's helpful, that's wonderful. But, you know, there are so many other options out there. And my goal as a journalist is to try to help people realize that there are so many different tools.
But that also seems, you know, that it can be confounding to a family coming in and saying, well, you know, this guy tells me that you got to go into a strict AA setting, or this person says no, you know, do this, and we've seen a lot of nightmares. Abby and I have heard of treatment programs that are nightmares. I'd like to understand a little better how you would counsel people, or not you, but like how you choose a program. What's legitimate? What isn't legitimate? Are there signifiers that tell me don't go to this place, or this is the place for you? How do you parse that out?
Well, that's a really difficult question. And one thing that I think is really important and that needs to be changed drastically, and we're obviously all on the same page about that, is that rehab in this country, treatment programs are a big black box. If you go to a cancer center, the cancer center is required by federal law to explain and publicize and let patients and consumers know. Consumers is the key word here. Patients, but the patients are also consumers, right?
Right.
To let them know what success they've had at treating X, Y, and Z cancers and what the remission rate is. And, you know, if this is, you know, I heard you say earlier, you know, would you just Google your cancer provider?
Right.
And, you know, that it's such a But cancer centers are required to publicize their success rates,
and
as are fertility clinics.
And right, and this is one of our one of our problems that we get into, and we're going to listen to David Sheff talk about that very issue when we come back to Right Turn Radio, where we're talking about treatment with Gabrielle Glazer from the New York Times.
Here's the thing is that there are, when I took my son in a total of about 10 programs over the course of about 10 years, when I look back, there were about three of them that were really good programs that offered, you know, trained professionals using, you know, evidence-based treatments, and those were the ones that he really thrived at. The other ones, though, were ones that, you know, in one place he would break rules and he was forced to go into the bathroom with a toothbrush and clean the tiles. I mean, wow. That was treatment. So, you know, so the question is, how do you find those three out of the 10? And so we have to do is become educated. And the first thing is to understand that, you know, we do have to rely on a medical model. We do want evidence. We do want treatment that has been tested and shown to work, because we don't want to waste our money. We don't want to waste our time. And moreover, you know, there's a time bomb, you know, going. There's a clock ticking, and we've got somebody who's in trouble. I mean, we are desperate by the time usually we get someone into treatment. So, you know, have to know what kinds of questions to ask. And then you do look for accreditation boards that are beginning to become more available and more effective. And they're, because it's not, in the past, there's been a lot of times where treatment programs, if there was any sort of guide, if there was any sort of licensing, it was not monitored. It was a lot of it was self-reported by the program. So if a program said, yeah, we use evidence-based treatments, we can treat bipolar disorder as well as addiction, you know, there was no way to know for sure if that was true. But now there is a new model, and places are going to become certified in ways that actually are meaningful. And so depending on where you are, you know, you have to do some research to find out, you know, what that certification would look like.
Why isn't this regulated?
Well, it should be, and I'm hopeful that it will be. It's not regulated. It really is like the Wild West out there, and there are people who, you know, I wrote, you know, this pair of books about addiction, and when I did, I started to hear from people all over the country, and the stories are they're horror stories, and people are sending their kids or themselves or adults, you know, their husbands, wives, parents, whatever it is, to places that in some cases are very inexpensive, but in some cases are outrageously expensive, $40,000 a month, no insurance, $50,000 a month, and they get treatment that is, you know, not one person in the facility has a degree in anything. I mean, their claim to fame or their credentials come from the fact that they themselves are clean 20 years later.
Right.
But that doesn't make you, I mean, somebody who has, you know, has been in recovery from cancer doesn't make them qualified to be a doctor. So right now in many states in America, if I wanted to, with no credentials whatsoever, if I wanted to open a coffee shop or a laundry, I would have to get a license and permits. But I could go and open up a rehab without any qualifications whatsoever. So it is not regulated. It is in need of complete overhaul. And one of the hopeful signs that things will change is that, sort of miraculously, the Affordable Care Act now, for the first time ever, requires insurance companies, you know, policies must cover addiction care and mental illness in the same rates and the same parity as they cover other diseases. And so my hope is that when insurance is paying, you know, companies are not going to be paying for this sort of untried, untested, you know, treatments that are unlikely to work. They're going to want accountability. They're going to want evidence-based treatments. And so the good programs will get stronger. The bad programs will either adapt or else they'll go out of business.
So that was from our interview with David Sheff, the author of Clean and Beautiful Boy. And we're joined by Gabrielle Glazer from the New York Times, who wrote a recent article about treatment. Gabrielle, what did you think of what David was saying?
Oh, I fully agree. Yeah, and I think
we thought you might.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We thought you might agree.
Yeah, I really fully agree. And when I was doing research for both this piece and a book I wrote about women and alcohol, what I found is that they're very shamed, they're very stigmatized, they feel terrible about having a problem in the first place, and they sometimes just want to go to a place that, that promises the most. And
right.
The key word there is promises. I mean, look at some of these places. And I don't mean to be calling names out, you know, places out by name, but they offer a sort of rainbow-tinged view of what's possible. And it's up to consumers to look and see, okay, what kind of evidence-based treatments do you offer? What is your long-term success rate, and how do you define success? Do you define success with reduced drinking days, or do you define success as complete abstinence? And unfortunately, at the moment, this is all up to us. If you have a loved one who needs treatment, and well, first of all, it's important to note that one of the best ways to get help and to seek help to get better is not necessarily in inpatient treatment. That's necessary if a person needs to detox, if they're using opioids perhaps, but it's not always fully necessary. And sometimes mm-hmm. outpatient treatment can be just as helpful, if not more helpful, than being away from your family for 60 days or 30 days.
Well, also more possible, especially for women, because
exactly.
I have never, you know, everybody who has kids or other responsibilities, it's really, really tough to say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to treatment for 3 months.
Right. And a man can sometimes get away with, okay, I got to, you know, I'm on a business trip for a month. Oh, okay. But women, even if they're, you know, regardless of whether they're working, it's really difficult. Who minds the home? Let's face it, women still do the lion's share. All the research shows that women still do the lion's share of domestic work, whether or not they're children. And it's really, really difficult for women to take off, especially for women to take off for a month or more and get help.
You mentioned evidence-based treatment, and so did David Sheff. Could you explain a little more what that means?
Yes. Evidence-based treatment is something that's been proven in science, in a randomly controlled double-blind study, and ideally more than one study. So what we know, for example, about cognitive behavioral therapy, which he mentioned and I mentioned and mm-hmm. you know, we've been discussing, we know that in really good scientific studies, that outweighs, when it's done correctly and when it's done with the person, a therapist who's well-trained in CBT, which it goes by for short, we know because science has told us that it really is going to outgun most other treatments of whether it's depression, whether it's addiction, whether it's, and, you know, again, I just used that word, even though I say that we're trying to get away from it. These are modalities that have been shown in research, in science, and engaged, analyzed,
right.
to be effective. That's what evidence-based treatment means.
And we love that. I think what we what we do at Right Turn is all based on evidence-based. We use the same stuff you're talking about. But it's also important, and you've mentioned this already, Gabriel, but it bears re-mentioning, is that to take an integrated approach to treatment. In other words, we love when people go to AA, NA, MA, moderation management. They go to smart recovery. We love that because it's working. You know, AA is a CBT program. If you break it down to what it is, we love treating. We love looking at the underlying causes of addiction. You mentioned depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, some other ones. We see all types. And if you don't, and the studies I've read recently is if you don't do it on those, if you don't integrate treatment that way, which many programs do treat it, but there's still a lot that don't.
Yeah, this is our one treatment, and this is how you should do it.
Right, then
exactly.
we don't have good results. So we're seeing that as the new horizon of treatment, and it's the bar is getting raised for people to come. Yeah.
Right, and I heard David mention that, you know, because the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, is now requiring insurance companies to pay for mental health and substance use disorders, that a lot of places are now going to be required to show that they are using evidence-based treatments. And I know that sounds like jargon, but basically, you know, it's what we can say is scientifically proven methods. And I know a lot of places are scrambling right now to be able to justify, if they do want insurance to pay for them, they're going to have to justify, oh, okay, here's why we're charging you $42,000 a month.
Well, that's a whole nother show topic. When we come back, we're going to hear a little more from David Sheff, and we'll be talking to Gabrielle Glazer.
Well, this is a disease that is progressive, which means, of course, it gets worse if it's not being treated. And this is a disease that starts out innocently enough with everyone who, you know, gets this disease. Nobody's trying to become addicted. Everybody's just doing what so many people do. You know, they get high, they have a drink, they smoke some pot. But some people, the estimate is about 10% of the population, has a predisposition, either because of genetics or other factors that mean that they will get ill with this disease. And, you know, once someone is addicted, their life is, there's a spiral downward. And sometimes people can function for many years before the worst of it catches up with them. And sometimes it happens almost instantly. But that's where, you know, that's where 80% of the crime in America comes from, people using drugs, crimes related to drugs, dealing, whatever it is, hospital visits, ER visits. And so since this is progressive and we know that it gets worse, just like with any other disease, you know, when you catch it, the first signs, you want to stop it from getting worse, because the debilitation can be irreparable, and the you know, the behaviors that come out when someone's addicted. I mean, before this was over, my son was breaking a door home. He was ripping us off. He was arrested. And then, you know, beyond that, of course, there's always the risk of death. And we are now losing in this country 350 people a day because of untreated addiction. So, you know, we got to get on it. We've got to get on it as quickly as we can.
So that was David Sheff speaking to us about why treatment is important. Gabrielle Glazer, freelancer for many, many publications, including the New York Times, author of the book that's coming out in paperback, Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. It's coming out Tuesday on paperback. That's pretty exciting. We have to have you back on the show, Gabrielle, to talk about the book. We're going to do another show about women and substance use. I was just wondering, when is the right time to intervene when you're seeing somebody going through difficulties? When do you go in and say, you know, let's look at this? How do people do that?
Well, I'll tell you when you don't do it. The one thing that's really important is we have this notion that's based on this graph that was produced in the 1940s that says a person has to hit bottom before they can get better.
Oh, good. I'm glad. And while I'm glad you're addressing this.
Yeah, while that may be true for some people, that the graph that upon which that is based was based on 98 men who belonged to AA in 1946, and they filled out a survey that described their experiences. The survey was mailed out to thousands of people in AA, and most of them were thrown out. And the scientist who turned out to be kind of a charlatan, he had bogus degrees on his resume that the internet today would have, you know, discovered in an instant, but this was being done in the 40s, and he could get away with a lot of big fibs, including a doctorate that he said he got in Germany in the 1930s, which he didn't get. Anyway, it behooved him to kind of promote this idea that you needed to hit bottom. It behooved a lot of people to promote this idea. And it was based on the surveys and experiences of 98 men, and it was reproduced and reproduced and reproduced and reproduced in magazines, on the back of doctors' offices, in posters. And we hung on to it as a belief.
Because it's a good way to kind of punish people who are misbehaving.
Exactly, and that is exactly what it is. It is only a belief. It is not science. And would you tell someone who is 280 pounds and has a cholesterol level, combined cholesterol level of you know, 380. Oh, you know what? Well, you haven't had a heart attack yet, but just keep on eating. Don't exercise. Keep on eating until you have a heart attack, and then we can treat you.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't make sense. So it makes far more, it's far more prudent to try to intervene when a condition is mild, when something starts to get out of control, when...
We're all nodding.
You know, yep. when the drinking, when the drug use starts to manage the person more than the person is managing their intake. And when, and for most people, only they can answer that for themselves. Only they can answer, oh, you know what, this is starting to bother me. I'm starting to look forward to this, name the substance, too much. This is starting to become more of a habit and less of a ritual.
So you're saying that intervention earlier, a smaller intervention. I mean, what we know is that bottom can be death, and that's not, you know, hitting
absolutely.
Bottom.
Absolutely, and we don't want it to get to that point. We don't want it to get to massive coronary, right. The equivalent that's of right. massive coronary. You know, we don't want it to get to Philip Seymour Hoffman. We want it to be able to say, you know what, let's look at this. Let's try to talk about it. We know this is a problem without threats.
Well, I mean, and I think what your article does is it gives people kind of the thought that there are other options, that if they're hearing from a professional, you know, this there's a different approach, or maybe we should try this, or maybe we should try that, that they should be researching something that fits their family member better.
Absolutely.
And the other thing we have to work on educating people about is that, you know, maybe the first try isn't the one. And it doesn't mean, you know, that the people there are bad necessarily. It means it might not have been a good fit. And, you know, I'd love to keep talking about this, but we're coming to the end of our time. And, you know, thank you for writing the article. And I recommend everybody read it. And her book's coming out. So do you want to, are you speaking anywhere about it or anything?
Actually, I've got a lot of radio interviews lined up. And it came out a year ago in hardback, and so right. This is the paperback. And
I know.
There's a lot of great new stuff in there about, you know, even newer evidence-based treatments. Speaking of our, I wish we had a better way to talk about that. Evidence-based
I know, it sounds so corny.
EBT. Well, we want people to check out Gabrielle Glazer's article on the New York Times.com, and her book, Her Best Kept Secret, is coming out in paperback July 15th, Tuesday. Gabrielle Glazer, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We want to get you back and talk about Her Best Kept Secret soon. Thanks for taking time today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it and appreciate what you guys are doing.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Please check us out on Facebook and at www.right-turn.org.